Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the reverberations from the FBI director's letter that has shaken Washington and rattled the presidential race, possibly slowing the momentum towards victory for Hillary Clinton and diminishing the chances that the Democrats will take the Senate, which will mean four more years of gridlock and no new appointments to the Supreme Court. Former White House counsel and author of The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, John Dean, whose testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, No, Emailgate is not worse than Watergate, and the ludicrous hyperbole coming from Donald Trump's absurd comparison of Nixon's impeachable crimes to Hillary Clinton's guilt by association because her top aide happens to have been married to a man who takes pictures of his genitals, while Donald Trump, on the other hand, grabs women's genitals. We will also assess whether FBI Director James Comey is politically tone-deaf or cynically partisan. Then we'll examine James Comey's ties to Wall Street and corporate America since he served as counsel to the world's largest hedge fund, Bridgewater, and Lockheed Martin, as well as serving on the board of the international bank HSBC, which has been massively fined for laundering drug money and helping wealthy Americans evade taxes. Jeff Hauser, the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss why Senator Elizabeth Warren has been critical of Comey's lack of interest in prosecuting white-collar criminals. Then finally, we'll look into an even more sensational political scandal than the one roiling Washington, and that is the revelations rocking South Korea that the country's president has been for decades under the spell of a cult leader of the Church of Eternal Life, essentially outsourcing her presidency to a fortune teller who has not only enriched herself by shaking down big conglomerates for more than $70 million, but has embezzled millions from the president's accounts by buying cheap clothes for the president to wear at state dinners while pocketing the difference for designer wear. Sue Mee Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, who was Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss growing protests and street demonstrations in South Korea demanding President Park Geun-hye's resignation. And joining us now is John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program, and is the New York Times bestselling author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. And he has an article in Monday's New York Times, No Emailgate is Not Worse Than Watergate. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Thank you.
And John, you've obviously spent a lot of time in Washington and played an important part in one of the most historical presidential scandals in history, which, of course, now Donald Trump is referring to, saying that what James Comey has uncovered in this ambiguous letter that he sent to the Republican chairs of various Senate and House committees is worse than Watergate. Obviously, there's a certain amount of hyperbole in that. But have you ever seen anything like this in terms of a letter that's so explosive, that's so partisan, within, 10 days of an election being dumped on the press?
Well, let's unpack that. A couple things you've raised. First of all is, of course, the Comey letter, which indeed is unprecedented. As somebody who worked at the Department of Justice before I went over to the White House, I know very well the rules of the department, and they don't even start investigations of campaign-related matters within probably about a 4 or 5 month period before an election. One of the things they did during Watergate, they said, we're not going to investigate any campaign act or law violations because the statute of limitations is ample long, and after the election, then we'll look at those situations. But I was also very aware that both the department and the FBI don't release information. Of course, that's what one of the ways Watergate was fueled was by breaking that requirement with through the FBI. We now know that the secret source for the Washington Post was the number two man in the FBI, Mark Felt, who was feeding the Washington Post and obviously influencing the election, and could have been fired for both the violation of the regulations of the department as well as the Hatch Act, which is the applicable law that keeps civil servants out of political matters. So, yes, that's the first issue, Comey's letter. Unprecedented and really, to me, serving only the interest of James Comey. Certainly not the department, certainly not the FBI, and certainly not Mrs. Clinton. Whether he is a partisan or not, I think time will sort all that out. I don't think he is unpartisan or nonpartisan, as he claims. Now, the next thing is the Trump jumping on it and making so much out of it, including claiming it's the biggest thing since Watergate. And that's what prompted me to write an op-ed piece for the New York Times, which I suspect prompts your call.
Indeed. And again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program. And his latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. And he has an article in Monday's New York Times, No Email Gate is Not Worse Than Watergate. So let's try and be charitable here. Is James Comey politically tone deaf? I mean, it doesn't sound like it. He became a kind of hero because he intervened when Ashcroft was already prepped for an operation, and he'd signed over the Justice Department to Comey, who was Deputy Attorney General, and we know the stand that he took along with the head of the FBI, Mueller, over warrantless wiretaps, which, of course, is something that you've testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about. The other point of it...
No, he's not tone deaf. He's not politically tone deaf. Right. And he knows exactly what he's doing. He's somebody who, I think, his self-righteousness is so overwhelming, and he's so convinced of his own purity that he's blind to the impact and doesn't care about it. He knows damn well it's going to affect the politics, but he just said he thinks he's above all that. And I think that's sort of Nixonian in many ways. It's also much like J. Edgar Hoover, who was the man who ruled the FBI for decades. And the reason they changed the law was because of Hoover, hoping to get people in there who were not partisan. And indeed, I think there have been about 8 or 9 directors since Hoover before Comey, and none of them have been as political as Comey.
Well, when you say, though, he's acting out of self-righteousness, is it an insular self-righteousness that we public servants are pure and all these politicians are
Yes.
corrupt? Or is it a self-righteousness that has a political tinge? I mean,
he has not been a particularly partisan political person. He is somebody who is a Republican. He has served under Republican presidents have given him his appointment. Apparently, he comes from a Republican family. I don't think he's been active in anybody's political campaign. He probably has made contributions on the right side. But I don't, as I say, I think, that, you know, from what I understand of people who know him pretty well, he values his integrity and works at it, but it also is, sort of his own. If he thinks he is right, everybody else is wrong, and he does it his way.
So do you give any credence to this rumor that going back to when his testimony, where he excoriated Hillary Clinton, which some people interpreted as, well, he's placating a bunch of angry FBI people who felt that Hillary Clinton should have been indicted, and that's why he's publicly excoriating her, to also to placate the Republican committees that he was testifying before. Frankly, at the time, I was astounded at what he said, because most of his criticism had nothing to do with criminal matters.
Well, that's right.
It was all to do with management style of Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's not the role.
There's always been an institutional difference between the State Department and the FBI. These two institutions have been at each other's neck for decades. It long preceded my time in Washington, which is 40 years ago, and it has certainly been consistent since. So these people have sniped at each other's management for a long time. They're just different cultures, different atmospheres, and what have you. It's cops versus diplomats is the nice shorthand for it. So Comey's gratuitous critique of Hillary's handling of emails, again, is outside the regulations of the Department of Justice. And exactly what they're told not to do is to make personal commentary on cases. So he's been violating the rules and regulations of the FBI and the Department of Justice consistently. That's what he did back in July when he first reported and gave his opinions. It was absolutely uncalled for him to go up to Congress and report to the Congress of why he was recommending no prosecution. He is not a prosecutor, but he gave the impression that it was his decision whether to prosecute or not. It actually was not. It was the Department of Justice's decision. It was somewhat complicated by the fact that Bill Clinton climbed on the Attorney General's plane and chatted with her and put her in something of a conflict situation. But that really didn't justify Comey's just utter disregard for a very, very long-standing practice. And that's it's to avoid exactly the kind of situations he's created. So how this is all going to shake out, I don't know. You know, I think the man, if he is the man of integrity he claims, will have his letter of resignation on Obama's desk on November 9th.
Well, of course, you mentioned the Hatch Act, and I don't see how that applies because there has to be an intention to affect the elections. I don't know how you prove that. That's certainly the speculation.
You don't. You do not need an intention to. If your actions, it's like criminal intent. Mm-hmm. The fact that you do something, you may not think it's criminal, but if you intend to do it, that is the intention that is deemed the mens rea needed to find it criminal. The Hatch Act is civil law. It's not a criminal law. And it just says you are prohibited from participating in politics. And he should know enough. In fact, a complaint has been filed by a very sophisticated lawyer, David Painter, who's currently a professor at the University of Minnesota's law school, but he was the White House counsel to Bush 2 for ethics. And he has filed a complaint against the director of the FBI that he has violated the Hatch Act. And he's taken it to the Office of Professional Responsibility.
So that could have some legs then, according to what you just told us.
It could. And I guarantee you, David is a very careful lawyer. He would not have filed this if he didn't think that there was a clear case in what's just based on the reported information.
Well, Harry Reid mentions that in his letter to Comey, but the minority head of the Senate also mentions in the letter that he sent to Comey that Reid hears from intelligence sources that Comey is sitting on some explosive information about Donald Trump's connections to the Russians and the extent to which the Russians are interfering with this election and perhaps trying to tip the scales for Trump. My intelligence contacts tell me that this is really an amazing hot potato and that what they've uncovered, or the NSA has uncovered, is an encrypted back channel from the Kremlin to the Trump campaign via the Alpha Bank, which is Arkady Rotenberg's bank, Putin's judo partner. And if that's true, and certainly Harry Reid has made a very clear innuendo that supports what I'm being told by intelligence sources, then this is unbelievable that a foreign hostile power is interfering with our elections, trying to help Trump, and Comey won't talk about that, but he will talk about this unsubstantiated, vague possibility that this this Carlos Danger, this outrageous, disgraced former congressman, his emails might be connected to Hillary Clinton.
It is true. And I, you know, you know how angry Harry Reid is, given that, that, first of all, the tone of the letter. His also saying in that same letter where he reveals the double standard and the hypocrisy of what Comey is doing, that he, Harry Reid, broke the Republican filibuster that was preventing the confirmation of Comey and because he thought he was a man of integrity. He said he now realizes he was very wrong on that. I mean, that is just a whack across the head. So he's lost all faith in Comey. So, you know, obviously been a very troubling election. Donald Trump is so far beyond the pale of any kind of norms of people who get nominated and get through the process to win the nomination. It just shows how bonkers the Republicans have gone. You know, this base that is, you know, obviously has serious grievances. They are low information voters. They are, many of them are not well educated. They're not necessarily, as the data shows, suffering financially, but they are suffering because the system is leaving them behind, and their children and their children's children will not likely do as well and get by as well as they have. These are the people that are forming the Trump base. They've developed these ultra hard right views. They are not fact based in their worldviews. I mean, their perception of reality is absolutely terrifying. So, I was hopeful that Hillary's election would you know, be overwhelming to show that they cannot. Yes, they have to be recognized as a serious constituency, and something needs to be addressed about their problems. But that has to be done in a real world view, and not this Breitbart conspiracy theory solution type of approach to politics. But now that's one of the things Comey's letter seems to be affecting, not the top of the tickets, but rather the down ticket races, which is equally as great a problem. I was hoping that at least Hillary would win the Senate, and then she could get something done. At least she could get her cabinet confirmed and a few people on the Supreme Court. But as you know, that's the latest gambit, is they may not ever confirm anybody as long as they have 60 votes that can block the filibuster in the Senate. I also think it's likely that they will blow up the filibuster if that's the case, when if the Democrats have a slight majority in when they reform in January and adopt their new rules, they will abolish the filibuster for all practical purposes with court appointments.
Well, I think that's reasonable to speculate about whether that's a motive, if indeed there are motives to be attributed. To President Obama doesn't believe that, according to his press spokesman, doesn't believe that Comey is intentionally influencing the outcome of the election.
I was very surprised at that. I heard that on the radio earlier today, and was surprised at the reaction. I think he just wants to stay out of it.
Right.
You know, he's got great numbers now. He's climbing back up. He's thinking legacy. He's thinking exit. And this is one nasty problem that Comey has. He put Comey in there. You know, it's very interesting the way the Democratic presidents have appointed Republican directors of the FBI. Do you think that a Republican president would ever appoint a Democratic head of the FBI? They just don't play that way.
Right, but just in closing, though, just putting aside the speculation that the Supreme Court, that there's an intention here to have the very down-ticket effect that you're talking about, because the key is the Supreme Court, and Hillary Clinton could appoint up to 3 judges, and if the Republicans retain the Senate, then she, according to John McCain and Ted Cruz, she won't be able to do a damn thing. So the gloves have been thrown down there in that regard. But back to the possibility of smoking guns being sat on by the FBI in terms of Russia's involvement and the connections, possible connections to the Trump campaign, my understanding from Russian experts that I talked to, that Putin's not so much trying to tip the scales for Trump, that he just wants to weaken America. And Trump would be a perfect vessel to weaken America. And that's what I find extraordinary. I believe that Trump would be a complete catastrophe for the United States and for the world. And not only would America be the laughingstock of the world, but I think we'd be greatly diminished and there'd be an enormous number of people, just about everybody that I know, that would simply wake up with a worse than a Brexit hangover and think, my God, what is happening to our country? And you may have half of the country if just literally in revolt. So
I agree. Trump would be a disaster if he doesn't even have a sophisticated newspaper knowledge of the way government and Washington work. He has no discipline whatsoever. There's an article out in the New York Magazine just came out today about how people in his campaign who've now passed through it realize how this man is totally unmanageable. He won't take the advice or counsel of anybody who really knows what they're talking about. That's one of the reasons his campaign is the disaster that it is. Every time he gets it on a level ground, he goes off and does exactly what his managers have told him not to. But anyway, it would just be awful, obviously, if this man were elected. So we must hope that the Comey letter doesn't disrupt that, but again, it is certainly going to create problems down ticket.
Well, just in closing, is there any way that these very patriotic Americans, you know, they're very red-blooded patriots, they're big Second Amendment defenders, they see themselves as patriots, is there any way to get them to understand that this guy that they support is going to hurt America?
No, they just don't believe it. They think that they need... You need somebody to go in and shake it up, and then the powers that be will come back in and think more about their problems and rebuild Washington from... Many of them know that Trump would be a disaster. So there's something of a protest. They're putting a stink bomb in Washington, knowing that it will just cause a nightmare. And this is part of their motive.
Well,
this is part of the Tea Party whole philosophy in shutting down government. They just want to cause problems.
Well, I'm going to have a number of sleepless nights until November the 9th, I'm afraid.
Let me tell you, Ian, I followed a lot of elections, as you have. This is the first one that I have ever had the angst that this one has caused, because Trump is incompetent. He is totally incompetent. It's typically been the case, while I might have disagreed with one party or the other, I didn't think that it threatened the well-being of the country. The market is starting to shake a little bit now. And God knows what would happen to the stock market if Trump were elected. But even Comey's letter blew off the gains last Friday, and it's still shaking today, not quite figuring out what's going to happen.
Well, John Dean, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, John. And again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to Nixon's resignation in 2006. He testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap programs, and he's the author of the New York Times bestselling books Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, and he has an article in Monday's New York Times, No Email Gate is Not Worse Than Watergate. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining James Comey's ties to Wall Street and corporate America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeff Hauser, the Executive Director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., who works to increase scrutiny on the executive branch appointments and ensure that political appointees are focused on serving the public interest rather than personal professional advancement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Hauser.
Thanks for having me.
And it doesn't seem as if what's going on with James Comey is so much about the revolving door in the sense that people trade in Washington, they trade in public service for private gain, although he did work on Wall Street and worked for many years as a counsel to one of the biggest defense contractors, Lockheed Martin. But at this point, what in his past, to your mind, Jeff, gives you the idea that he would be so politically tone deaf? If you're being charitable and not suggesting a political motive here in trying to, you know, manipulate the elections, which is whether he intended it or not, that's going to be the effect of what he's done. There's no two ways about that. But just to be charitable for a moment, what to your mind explains what some people say is simply a political tone deafness?
Well, the FBI has considerable discretion to determine what its investigative priorities are. And in the years leading up to the financial crisis and in the years since, they've dedicated far too few resources to scrutiny of white-collar corporate crime, despite that being very much a part of their mission and their stated mission. And I think that when you have somebody who's been a defense contractor, general counsel, and general counsel to the largest hedge fund in the world, you don't tend to view the greatest problems in America as white-collar corporate criminality. You tend to potentially focus on, say, misuse of email servers as a bigger issue than generating the largest financial crisis since the Great Depression.
Well, prior to the 2008 crisis, my understanding is that one of the reasons why the cops weren't on the beat there was after 9/11, hundreds of FBI agents looking into white-collar crime were transferred into counterterrorism. So has that vacuum ever been filled in terms of FBI priorities, where so much is dedicated to counterterrorism and so little to white-collar crime?
No, is the short answer. And I think that an FBI director who was a little bit more focused on addressing white-collar crime have been for years now. I mean, he was confirmed in 2013, raising public attention to a lack of resources and calling for an increase in FBI budget to address these issues. And there's I've looked, and there's no evidence that he has been loudly raising alarms. I don't have the resources to hold accountable those executives who brought about the economic crisis.
Well, but during the tenure at the Justice Department for Attorney General Eric Holder, his deputy attorney general in charge of Wall Street, or at least policing Wall Street, was a complete catastrophe. Didn't bring about one prosecution. And many critics said that Eric Holder himself, coming out of Wall Street law firms and going back to one, wasn't exactly the best cop on the beat. So there seems like a lot of blame here.
Oh, I think that unfortunately that you're right, that both Eric Holder and his head of DOJ criminal, Lanny Brewer, each came to the Justice Department from Covington and Burling, a powerful D.C. White-collar corporate defense law firm, and then went back to it after their stint in the Justice Department. So I don't want to suggest that James Comey solely alone is what has stood between the law and Goldman Sachs and HSBC and the like. But I do think he is a cog in it. I think that the fact that he was put on the board of a bank, HSBC, that has a history of it helping money launderers, that even Republicans find HSBC's behavior to be criminal. And there were, in 2012, that was the bank that led Eric Holder to suggest essentially that some banks are too big to jail. And after those statements, Comey went onto the board of HSBC in 2013 prior to becoming FBI director. And so HSBC developed a relationship with the FBI director that has proved helpful in continuing to keep their executives out of jail. So I don't think he's doing this alone, but I do think that he is representative of a broader problem. And I also don't know what job he is going to take after he leaves as FBI director, be it on November 9th or be it at the end of his potential 10-year term in 2023. I rather suspect he's going to revolve out yet again to a highly lucrative job.
Now, in terms of Comey being on the board of HSBC, didn't they pay the biggest fine, one of the biggest fines in history for money laundering for drug cartels?
They did pay such a fine, and it's kind of amazing when a corporation can commit such a heinous act, and yet no human beings have any culpability in it. It just sort of happened in this mystical way of a corporation without people. And I think we all know that corporations are made up of people who work there, and the disconnect in the corporate responsibility and accountability from the individual, I think, is a systemic problem in law enforcement, and it's one that I do not believe James Comey is particularly committed to resolving.
Well, I believe that Elizabeth Warren, prior to this current scandal over the letter to the Republican chairs of the Senate and House committees that has blown up this election, that Elizabeth Warren had called out Comey for that very reason, that he wasn't being sufficiently committed to cleaning up fraud on Wall Street. So am I correct in that, that Elizabeth Warren has been critical of Comey before this situation just blew up?
Absolutely. It's worth remembering the kind of extraordinary press conference that James Comey threw on July 5th with no sign-off from anyone. As he said, no one knows what I'm about to say. And he gave this very self-serious speech in which he talked about the desire to keep informed and meet the intense interest in the Clinton email case with him editorializing against Clinton, despite also saying that she had not committed a crime that would be prosecutable. And that was a very interesting speech, because if you set forth the standard of, well, we're going to tell you about our investigations, even if they don't lead to indictment, if there's intense American people interest, one would normally think that might include the crimes, or at least the investigations into the activities that led to the financial crisis. And so Warren sent a letter in mid-September 2016 to Comey saying, well, if your standard now is if the American people would be very interested in an investigation that did not lead to indictment, I'm going to tell you about it. Tell us about what you learned about Wall Street and other financial actors. And, of course, to this day, there is not a response from Comey to Senator Warren of any kind.
So let's go briefly through the resume of Comey. This is what I know, and fill me in on what you know, Jeff. He first came into sort of public scrutiny as an assistant prosecutor on the Whitewater investigation into the Clintons, which was a completely bogus waste of money, but it certainly was politically damaging to the Clintons. And then he came to a lot of attention when he took a stand as a deputy attorney general when Ashcroft was the attorney general, was about to have an operation. He turned over the DOJ to Comey, and Comey and Mueller made a stand by the bedside against Card and Gonzalez of the Bush administration, who were trying to have him sign off on having Ashcroft, who was under anesthetic, sign off on a continuation of some secret NSA wiretap situation that we still don't know about to this very day. That sort of made him a hero. Then he had that sort of interregnum where he was counsel for Lockheed Martin, and then counsel for, what is it, Bridgewater? What was the name of the big...
Bridgewater. In Connecticut. Not the city, but the hedge fund, which is the world's largest hedge fund.
Right. And also sat on the board, or was appointed to the board of HSBC, a very troublesome bank that's been charged with money laundering and also hiding all kinds of tax-dodging accounts for rich Americans. So anything that I've missed out on here?
Well, there's also, he started out as a prosecutor and then went to McGuire Woods and was a law firm partner for a few years in the mid-90s prior to returning to government. And I think the consistent pattern has been government service, then profiting, government service, then profiting. And he's back in government service again, and I don't think that we should assume that his profiting off that government service is at an end. And I think that the type of people who would consider hiring him after he leaves the FBI, whenever that is, are the type of people who find the Wall Street Journal's editorials to be words of wisdom. I think it's going to be people who are going to who are anti-Hillary Clinton, and I think that his opinion in the eyes of people who cut really big checks has gone up, even if he has received a lot of media criticism in the last 72 hours.
Well, just in the last minute then, Jeff Hauser, to some people, this looks like the patriarchy striking back at the last minute just before a woman is about to be elected president for the first time, a woman who is pro-choice, who is a feminist, the worst nightmare for a lot of people, particularly on the right wing, particularly males, who, you know, you just said that this guy could be rewarded immensely. He'd be rewarded immensely if Donald Trump becomes president, I take it. And this would go down in history as the revenge of the patriarchy.
I think that's right. I think that the focus, the scrutiny, the notion that the desire to prove a pre-held opinion that there is something deeply criminal about Hillary Clinton comes out of a whole mix of motives, but sexism is clearly one of them. And I just think it's very hard. I mean, Clinton is a skilled politician. She is a professional who has served her country for a long period of time. She clearly has flaws, but the notion that she is particularly problematic and has flaws that are unusual among political leaders seems totally baseless and gendered, even as her considerable skills, as I think the country saw in the three debates, those skills are unusually significant. But I don't think there's any evidence to this date that anything she's doing is unusual, including sending emails privately. That's actually like this hidden secret that in Washington everyone does it. Yeah, I think it's a failed revenge of the patriarchy is not a bad way to think about it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeff Hauser.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Hauser, Executive Director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where he works to increase scrutiny on executive branch appointments and ensure that political appointees are focused on serving the public interest rather than personal professional advancement. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the scandal rocking South Korea, whose president has been under the spell of a cult leader for decades. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, who previously was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you for having me on.
And this scandal that we have about a week from the elections involving the letter from the FBI, of course, is consuming everybody's attention. But there's a even more extraordinary and bizarre political scandal going on in South Korea that has been in the works now for decades. It seems that the president of South Korea has essentially outsourced the presidency to a fortune teller who has been shaking down big business for, she's apparently, you know, enriched herself to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. She's in charge of the president's life, chooses her clothes. In fact, cheats her on her clothes, gives her cheap stuff. Well, pocketing the balance, and she shows up at state dinners wearing, you know, something from Marshalls, you know.
It's
unbelievable. Give us the story in broad strokes.
Yes, it is unbelievable what's going on in South Korea to people who are not used to this kind of controversies. But actually, in South Korea, almost every single presidency has, you know, every single president has been scandalized in some way. The Myung-bak presidency was scandalized by revelations of corruption. Roh Moo-hyun, who previous president to Lee Myung-bak, who subsequently committed suicide. I mean, this is sort of, this kind of dramatic story is fairly common in South Korea. That said, you're right. The scandal that's currently unfolding in South Korea is very controversial, and it threatens President Park's presidency. It could end it. There's strong voices. I mean, tens of thousands of people have protested calling for the resignation of President Park Geun-hye or impeachment of President Park Geun-hye with 1 year left to go. And it's kind of a bizarre story. While the public is used to more straightforward corruption story, it's not that President Park herself is accused of corruption for her and her family members, which is usually what's more common in South Korea. It's just that she has this bizarre relationship with this woman for decades now, and she has outsourced, as you said, almost all decisions, both major and minor, to this woman, to this one so-called friend that she had. So this is it's scandalous. It has huge ramifications in terms of foreign policy decisions, and even what's going to happen in terms of presidential election next year.
But isn't there also a sort of tragic element to it, in as much as what made President Park Geun-hye vulnerable to this kind of manipulation by this family friend who inherited the fortune-telling role from her father? So this has been going on for decades.
Yes, President Park initially became... became friends with this woman, Cho's father, after President Park's mother, was assassinated by the North Koreans, and after her own father was assassinated, President Park Chung-hee, in 1979, she had really no family members left at all, and so this woman, Cho's father, befriended Park Geun-hye, and it was this relationship that President Park has formed with this family. And once this Cho's father died, who was a cult-like religious leader, President Park then developed this very strong bond and relationship with this woman, Cho.
So could you make the case that President Park has some kind of PTSD, some kind of traumatic vulnerability, having lost both parents, one the mother to the North Koreans and the other was, I believe, assassinated in South Korea. You know, she's basically a vulnerable person.
She is vulnerable, and one criticism that she has consistently faced from everyone is that she only trusts very few people. So she's not transparent. She's not an open person. And you can see why. She probably has some trust issues. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. But so probably the fact that she befriended this woman at such a vulnerable age, and President Park values loyalty. So as bizarre as this seems, it's just a wrong judgment on President Park's part to have had this kind of relationship with this woman.
So focusing that now on Choi Soon-sil, the cult leader's daughter, with this decade-long connection to the president of South Korea, she's basically been shaking down big, powerful companies, has she? Corporations in South Korea, and she's also been had access to the president's fund, for state dinners and buying clothes, which she gets cheaply.
Right.
I mean, the level of access to the highest. I mean, she's had access to the highest level strategies and communications for South Korea in its problems dealing with North Korea, has she not?
Yes, that's exactly the problem. So as you mentioned, she benefited greatly. She collected some $70 million from various chamber companies for her so-called cultural foundation. So, and she siphoned up money for her personal use. For example, to pay for equestrian training for her daughter. But you're absolutely right. What concerns me is foreign policy implications. If the public finds out that President Park asked for Cho for advice on North Korea affairs, for example, the decision to deploy THAAD, the missile defense, to South Korea, or the decision to close off Kaesong Industrial Complex, the joint venture that South Korea was doing with North Korea. If all these decisions came from Cho, I'm now afraid there will be a backlash against President Park. And even decisions such as that deployment might be re-questioned. So that's what concerns me.
But she's, got 1 year to go in her term? And this will make her pretty much a lame duck, won't it, this scandal?
Yes, she was already looking at lame duck status. But regardless now what happens, whether she's impeached or she resigns, or even if that doesn't happen, and that might not happen because the opposition cannot, they might actually want some time before they could gather together and have an actual person who can win the elections. They might not want this kind of accelerated time frame. But regardless of what happens to Park, and even if there is not a collapse of the Park government, I would say that she has absolutely cemented her status as lame duck, and not much is going to come out of this government for the remaining term.
But how does this weakened government play with North Korea that has a history of being incredibly provocative? They've been even ratcheting up the bellicose propaganda against the United States, against THAAD. And
yes, and this is absolutely my biggest concern, that North Korea will absolutely try to exploit this and even decide to act even more provocatively. And because President Park is in no position to act, and it just might, we might get into sort of a escalation spiral situation, things spiraling out of control. So that's my biggest concern right now.
So let's talk a little bit we had a sort of mini scandal with President Reagan's First Lady Nancy, who apparently consulted with an astrologer, and that became kind of more grist for late night comedy television than anything else, but apparently it was quite real. Tell me a little bit about the Korean culture that would be susceptible to these kinds of cult leaders, because we're all familiar with the Reverend Moon and his cult, which has a powerful international cult, and he has peculiar ties to North Korea as well. So what is there anything to be made? Not that the United States is not exactly a fertile ground for religious and political cults.
Yes. But this is unusual because Nancy Reagan was not the president. This is the president of South Korea who has made all these decisions. So this is more serious. And I think that's what the Korean public cannot understand, is that this is not a simple corruption scandal that we are used to. The South Koreans are used to hearing about all kinds of corruption scandal. As I told you, Lee Myung-bak to Noh Moo-hyun to Kim Dae-jung, even the Nobel Prize winner, Kim Dae-jung's sons were arrested in 2002 for siphoning of large sums of money. Kim Il-sung administration before that President Notaewoo, Chun Doo-hwan. I mean, it's every single president in South Korea. But what makes this case unusual is that president, it just makes her look, I hate to use this word, but ridiculous, because it's very bizarre. It's not even a simple, understandable corruption issue, because it's not like she benefited personally. She did not, you know, steal money like President Notaewoo did, or, you know, somebody. This is just, it's just so bizarre that she's just now a laughingstock. This is why I say, even if she survives the presidency, she's absolutely a lame duck, and nobody trusts her, and she's just not a credible leader, because people just cannot understand how she was able to let this woman, a very bizarre woman, a shamanistic, a cult-like person, to make all these decisions behind the scenes. So that is what's unusual, not your normal corruption scandal, sure, which is not unusual in South Korea,
right,
I'm afraid.
Well, it kind of looks good by comparison, right?
Right.
Plain old-fashioned
right.
corruption. If only we had more.
Well, I'm frustrated for President Park, because she's actually known to be very principled and, you know, not easily corruptible. And this case is not about her corruption, right? It's not about her stealing money or her benefiting. It's just unexplainable relationship with this woman. It's truly bizarre and very sad, actually.
So when you've got 12,000 people in the streets protesting and demanding that she step down, is there anybody that can fill the vacuum there that could maintain some stability, given how volatile the situation always is in South Korea, with North Korea next door having this belligerent and erratic young leader?
Well, that's why her own ruling party members are calling for her to just form a new government with centrist folks and even people from her opposition party who can basically rule. But she would not be a credible leader, but it was just run by a prime minister and a new cabinet that she appoints. And I think the opposition party is thinking that this might not be a bad idea, because, again, she only has 1 year left to go, and they would like to have some time to maneuver so that they can, you know, increase their chance to win in a year. And they have a candidate, Moon Jae-in, who is the most likely person to win, that comes from the former opposition party. The presidential election in 2017 really is a contest between Ban Ki-moon, the current UN Secretary General, and Moon Jae-in, the former leader of the opposition party. And before this scandal broke, Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General, was expected to win, but now Moon's odds of election have increased with this scandal, with this current scandal.
So that's an ironic outcome, isn't it? If
it is an ironic outcome. So probably Secretary General Ban is now going to distance himself from the ruling party and try to, if he decides to run, he'll run by forming yet another party. But regardless, the opposition party candidate, Moon Jae-in's chances have increased because of this scandal. And after 10 years of conservative rule, President Park, and before President Park, President Lee Myung-bak, South Koreans may feel that it's time to change the administration. As it often happens in the United States, too, when you know, a party rules for a long time, a public wants to change. And then that has ramifications and implications for U.S.-South Korea alliance issues, as well as North Korea policy issues.
But isn't there also a similarity between South Korean politics and American politics in terms of the sort of Bernie Sanders factor, for the want of a better description, that there is a growing income disparity and that nothing has been done to, and you mentioned shaking down the chaebols, the big conglomerates which seem to control the economy. Is that likely to be an issue in this campaign, that the political...
Absolutely. And I think this part of the public fury in the wake of the scandal is feeding on the larger fears that public has about the weakening state of South Korean economy, as you mentioned, rising inequality. And then public is just fed up with this very persistent corruption between big business chaebols and the government, this corruption between government and business. So there are a lot of just kind of percolating issues that are at the core. And this just sort of this latest scandal is just sort of it's sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. There's a lot of deeper pent up frustration in South Korea right now, both with the economy and with also President Park, because she was known to have very aloof and very opaque style of governing. She was not transparent, so there was this kind of deep pent up frustration.
Well, just in closing, do you think then that the political left will come back in because of the inequality issues? And will that affect, for example, building the base on the controversial base on Jeju Island? Is there likely to be a political change away from conservative rule in South Korea?
I think it is now the chance has very much increased. So, as I said, I think Moon Jae-in from the opposition party looks like he has an excellent chance to potentially become the next president. And when that happens, there will be changes. He's a former human rights lawyer, so he's expected to adopt tough on business policies domestically. He will probably take more accommodating stance toward North Korea than President Park. And U.S., there's some ramifications to U.S.-South Korea alliance. Now, that said, Ban Ki-moon, the U.N. Secretary General, is still a popular figure in Korea. So it all depends on how he handles this crisis. If he distances himself from President Park and the ruling Saenuri Party and forms his own party, I think the 2017 presidential contest will really come down to between those two, Ban Ki-moon and Moon Jae-in, former leader of the opposition party.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sumi Terry.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, and she was previously the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye for now.